avec.
Avec le Anne Hathaway.
Oui. Les film autres. Qui s'appelait Dirty Rotten Scoundrels il y a, il y a 20 ans. Et maintenant...
Non, c'est pas
pire.
Bon, si on est vivant.
C'est une version inférieure.
Guys, shut the F up.
This is Unorthodox, the universe's leading Jewish podcast. I am Mark Oppenheimer, joined as ever by my co-hosts, Tablet Deputy Editor Stephanie Butnick.
Hello.
And Senior Writer at Tablet Magazine, Leah Leibowitz.
31 days to the Omer, but who's counting?
And today, we bring you an interview with James Beard Award-winning chef and restaurateur Edward Lee, and with Judith Viorst, the legendary author of many of your most beloved childhood books, including Alexander and, what was it?
The No Good, Very Bad.
Horrible Day, which I have to say, I don't think my parents read me children's books. Like, I know some because I'm reading them
to my
kids.
We know, you sat in that one chair, you all shared the chair, no one got children's books.
Wait, those are different stories. I like how all my childhood has been collapsed.
They sort of fit together. Like, we only eat Friendlies and Pizza Hut. There's one share and no children's books. This, to us, is your childhood.
Okay, what's her new book, though?
But it's like, the truth. There are children's books I know because I've read them to my kids. But if I think, like, what is a childhood memory of being read to? I don't – I mean, somebody must have, right? But – But
we'll get to that later.
Anyway, we'll get to that later.
Maybe your session later today.
But Judith Viorst has a new memoir called Nearing 90 and Other Comedies of Late Life. And she is terrific. And it's going to be exciting to talk to her. But first, you know what's exciting, Stephanie? What's exciting?
We wrote a book.
Who wrote a book?
The three of us.
We did?
We did. I don't know if you remember.
Us? It's called The Newish Jewish Encyclopedia. And it comes out this fall. It is an A to Z guide of everything Jewish.
It has more than 1,000 entries covering everything from modern Orthodoxy to the marvelous Mrs. Maisel, from Golda Meir to that other Israeli heroine, Gal Gadot. There are guides to each of the Jewish holidays. There are explanations on the differences between Reform and Conservative and Orthodox Judaism. And there's also a guide to cursing in Yiddish, Hebrew, Ladino, and other languages.
Ladino cursing?
Oh, yeah.
This may be the first book ever to give us Ladino cursing. Yeah, we sat down and realized we needed to write a book that has everything you could ever want or need to know. If you're Jewish, if you have a friend who's Jewish who needs this book, or if you're just some random Jew-curious person, we want to satisfy your Jew curiosity. This book is full of contributions from great unorthodox guests like Molly Yeh, A.J. Jacobs, Jordan Hoffman, Marjorie Ingle, and many, 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 many more.
So many of us suffer from this kind of Jew shaming.
Jew embarrassment.
Yeah. We're like, oh, you know, I should really know more. Or like, I can't believe that I went to Hebrew school all these years, but I don't really know what's the difference between, you know, Tanis Esther and Tzom Gedalia. This is a book.
Or
that,
even between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Or even between.
Or like Simcha Torah and Shemini Atzeret.
Yeah. Or Judaism don't. And everything else. But yeah. The point is just to
Why is Barbara Streisand spelled with B?
With no
B-R-A.
Additionally.
Yeah.
The point is just to have a book that is to books what this podcast is to podcasts. Just very relaxed, very, shall we say, unorthodox.
Yeah.
And a lot of the questions that we've been asked either by Gentiles or by listeners are in there. Like, you can find the answers to questions you have.
They are.
So the book is out October 1st. You can actually pre-order it now. And we're going to be doing a bunch of fun contests
and giveaways.
We're
going to have an Oktoberfest.
Yes, we're going to have an Oktoberfest. It's coming out right in time for the high holidays. And we're going to be doing some like really fun giveaways for listeners who buy the book and stuff like that. But first, we want to tell you that we're going on a book tour this fall. We'll be doing events all over the country where we talk about the book and take you from A to Z.
From Aaron to Zyklon B.
Literally from Aaron to Zyklon B. That's the scope of this book.
So if you want us to come to your local bookstore, synagogue, or JCC, just send us an email at unorthodox@tabletmag.com with the subject line book tour.
Yep.
And we'll figure something out.
Book tour, party book time, tour. Excellent.
It's the newest Jewish encyclopedia on sale October 1st. Bring us to town. Abraham to Zabar's, Aaron to Zyklon B.
It will make you a rabbi in 3 sittings. It will make you a Hasidic master. It will open your world. It will change your life. You need this book.
We'll literally crack your skull open, fill it with Yiddishkeit, and sew it back up.
Think how proud your mother would be.
And don't worry,
so
Ashkenormative is an entry.
So much cheaper than day school.
So that's the number one thing that's going on with us. I actually have another issue that's pressing that will be familiar to people of this podcast. Something that's not covered in the book, and that is I have a sneaking into the movies question. And this is ripped straight from the headlines of Oppenheimer life in the 06515. Sunday afternoon, my wonderful 5-year-old daughter, Anna, is invited to a birthday party at the Cinemark Cineplex in North Haven.
Cinemark Oppenheimer.
By the way, when I got there,
spelled with a C.
By the way, when I got there, I realized I could have taken the gift certificate that they gave me at Adat Shalom in Los Angeles. Remember, they gave us each a present suited to us, and they gave me a Cinemark gift certificate so that I could.
They literally figured out which was your local place, exactly, since they could get you the right.
And
thing.
I forgot it, so I'm gonna bring it next time. But I'm there. I don't have, and so Anna is going with her friend Cora, whose birthday it is, and 10 other little Muppets to see Ugly Dolls. But it's a drop-off party, as they say, which means I can leave for 3 hours. Like, they're going to have pizza and cake first and then watch Ugly Dolls. I'm supposed to come back 3 hours later. So I could leave, or I could stay and see a movie myself. And Sid, God bless her, my wonderful wife, had said to me when we were discussing like 5 or 6 days ago the plan for the weekend and who's driving where and what's all the coordinating. She said, look, and your job is to get Anna to her movie at Cinemark and then stay and see a movie yourself, because I know you love going to the movies by yourself. And she's like, go, take a movie for yourself. The only thing that's playing, this is actually irrelevant, but the only thing that's playing that meets the time constraints is The Hustle, which with Anne Hathaway and Rebel Wilson, which I ended up seeing, and it's fine. It is not as good as the movie it's based on, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, but it's fine. But here's the question. In such a situation where I've already crossed past the little turnstile, so to speak, to get into the area with the movie theaters, to go to
drop Anna off?
To drop Anna off in the party room, which is actually next to, it's in the sort of row where all the movie theaters are. Am I allowed to stay and then pop into a different movie?
Okay, question. So did you buy a ticket for Anna? Or like, how does it work for a birthday party?
No, Cora's family bought all the kids tickets.
You're like, I'm here for the party. And then you both go through.
And they just wave you right through. Exactly. Wow. So they've waved me through. Nothing illegitimate there.
Look, my God. I think I just figured something really important out.
What's that?
Just bring a kid, be like, I'm here for the party.
I'm here for the party, right.
There's a party.
There's always a party.
And there's pizza. Oh, movie theater pizza. Yeah. I think you're fine because you did a nice, like, it was in service of your daughter having a fun day, this Cora's birthday. I'm actually okay with you then taking a different movie.
Yep. Interesting. Here. So, and
you deserve this.
Because
you've earned it.
Family of Cora is supporting the local institution. Like, I think you're not actually taking anything away from anyone by sitting in a movie theater.
Cora's family, Mark parented. Mark deserves.
He babysat. He babysat his daughter.
He deserves his.
For relatively new listeners, we should say that I have sometimes been chided for my belief. You know, some people, they think it's okay to drive 10 miles over the speed limit. My thing is, I think it's okay if you see one movie to leave that movie and go into another one, provided you've paid for the first. Maybe listeners have thoughts on this. Unorthodox at tabletmag.com. What's going on with you, Liel?
I came back from another kid-related activity. The famed, the famous, the great Heschel camping trip was for the second grade was this weekend.
Did you chaperone?
There ain't no party like a Heschel camping trip party, because a Heschel camping trip party has a van full of meat. We grilled like
it was literally like a shawarma mobile.
Literally
a food truck.
Like, you know, on Shabbat where you cannot grill the meat for like a hot second, there was a cold cut lunch. I'm doing air quotes right now, because it was like 7 pounds of pastrami, 7 pounds of corned beef. Like, it was like the most amazing spread you've ever seen. And the kids are basically completely self-sufficient. So what you do is you sit in your little lawn chair and you eat meat and you talk to your buddies. And you get points. You're like, oh, you took your kid camping. That's so sweet.
Yeah, you're
like
a good dad.
Yeah, I ate 17 pounds of steak, drank a fifth of bourbon, and saw my kid like twice. It was an amazing weekend.
Mazel tov.
Yeah.
Good chaperoning work.
Great parenting, both of you.
Great parenting.
Happy almost Father's Day.
And they're also like, this camping trip, like, it's amazing because as soon as they get there, they basically turn into like little Israelis. They're like, give me something I could fashion into a weapon. Now give me give me a steak. Let's go find an enemy.
Is there an educational purpose to this trip, or is it just like team building?
Fun.
Okay, yep. That's great.
You do tefillah. You do a little hike.
Little hiking.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Stephanie, what's up with you? How was the wedding?
It was amazing. It was
amazing.
So fun.
How'd your speech go?
My speech went well. Ben and I also did the motzi, which we practiced. We were pretty good at it.
Nice.
Do you want to give us a version?
Well, I tried to do the Grandpa Al version, which he did in mine, which is like, Baruch Asah Adonai. You really need that gravitas, so right. I channeled Grandpa Al.
Yeah.
That Ashkenazi.
Yeah. 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 That flair.
Yeah, that's
But it was
awesome.
Amazing, and I'm so happy for that.
You want to give us your matron of honor speech, though?
Well, it started like this. Hi, I'm Stephanie. You might remember me from the motzi.
Did you really? That's a good line. little sad news this week, little news of the Jews. Herman Woke died, the 103-year-old Herman Woke, author of Marjorie Morningstar, Winds of War, The Caine Mutiny. Has either of you guys, have you read your Herman Woke?
Oh, I think all of them.
You read all of them?
I think basically. Have my dad any? Was a huge fan.
Really? Have you read any, Stephanie?
No, but it's the one of the things I like feel shame about. Like, I know I'm supposed to have done that.
Which is hilarious because only people who work at a Jewish magazine feel they're supposed to have done that because he's so important to American Yiddishkeit. But he actually, one of the points that all the obituaries made was he was so derided by the critics. Like, so he was seen as such middle brow, low, barely middle brow, low brow trash. But of course, he actually writes books that people want to read. But funny Oppenheimer-Fremer story about Herman Woke. In high school, Sid had an AP U.S. history teacher who just went very methodically and slowly, and he was apparently very good, but he only got them up to about 1905, and then it was time for the AP test in late April or early May. And she ended up getting – I mean, it's Sid, so she got a 5. But the reason that she – knew 20th century history. She's like, well, I'd read all of Herman Woke's novels. Like, I knew World War I, World War II, you know, founding of Israel, like just all Herman Woke. And she was very serious about that. By the way, he was one of the interviews that got away. We were trying to get him to talk to us at Tablet. And we thought that when he published a book at age 100 3 years ago, he'd like come on our show. And his publicist was like, yeah, Herman's just chilling in Palm Springs.
We started this podcast, Herman was 100 years old.
But he was writing, and we were always trying to get him.
Herman gets a pass.
They always said, you know, Herman's on the golf course. Like, he doesn't have time for
you
guys.
I mean, our guest today, Judith Viores, is a spring chicken at 90.
Anyway, Herman Woke, we will miss you. We'll do a big read of one of your – I've never read Marjorie Morningstar.
Me either. Let's do that.
Which is I've been thinking about our summer reading. I'm thinking I want everyone to read Pete Holmes.
I think Marjorie Morningstar is a great tribute.
I think Marjorie Morningstar would be great. And then our frequent guest, Taffy Brodesser Ackner, has her novel coming out June 1st. I'm thinking those are my three Jewish books for the summer, maybe. I mean, Pete Holmes being the most Jewish of
the
them
most,
in,
of course.
In its ways. What else is going on with news? Liel, do you have a Eurovision update for us?
Oh, do I have a Eurovision update? Of course I have a Eurovision update.
It happened. Since we last spoke with the J. Crew, Eurovision happened.
Eurovision happened. Holland. Mazel tov, a Simento one. Not Belgium.
Some of the more dour people. You don't see the Netherlands as really having the ability to camp it up like that.
They brought it on. North Macedonia was very close on their heels with a power ballad. But they won Israel 23 out of 26. But hey. You know,
how did Andorra do? Were they were strong?
I don't know that the Andorrans. Isn't
this
that
is
like
literally
Star
like
planet?
This is
how
like
about the
Model
Monegasques
UN.
From Monaco? It is Monaco. It's Model
singing.
UN.
I would have done this.
Here are like a couple of important takeaways. First of all, Israel threw an amazing party. Second of all, to make up for that horrible video we discussed last week, they made another video. And this one is Gal Gadot riding in a cab in Tel Aviv, showcasing the beauties of the city. At some point, she's like, and you really have to know, people here are very direct. And then the cab driver turns to her and be like, Superman and Batman made more money than you, yeah? It's like so incredible. But the most incredible thing, I mean, there was Madonna putting on her Moshe Dayan costume with like an eye patch and like a lot of nonsense.
Actually?
Yeah, no, for real.
Wow.
We're not making stuff up now. But the most amazing thing, there was a band from Iceland. I cannot even begin.
I don't like Björk, and by extension, I don't like Icelandic music. And I'm just going to put that out there just so the haters can hate on me.
I love Björk. I love Iceland. I love everything about this tiny little strange country. However, these individuals arrive. They are a unique combination of humans who support both BDS, which is the practice of, you know, boycotting Israel for ideological reasons, and BDSM, which is the practice of, you know, sexual, you know, fetish.
Sadomasochistic submission, domination.
They performed half naked, wearing what really I could only describe as like very elaborate tefillin.
And like they also, bondage tefillin.
Yes, bondage tefillin. But it's like literally around their arms, right? And like head. And they have like weird masks, and they've had some plastic surgery done to look like non-gendered alien stuff. And their big protest was like, oh, here, we're going to wave a Palestinian flag during the intermission. Now, here's how badass Israelis are. They did this little shtick. They felt so good about themselves. And then they get on their flight. And the flight attendant tweeted like, huh, the Icelandic, you know, protest band is on our flight. Guess which seats they got? The El Al crew went and made sure that they're all having separate, not seating together, separate middle seats, like the shittiest seats on the plane, and then tweeted about it. Like, you do not fuck with us.
We'll give you middle seats back to Iceland.
Like giving... You're sitting 36J, by the way, and it doesn't recline. And your computer, like the little screen is broken.
And you by get the a way, kosher meal, yeah, bitch.
Exactly. And you get the glot kosher meal. But I'm very proud of my people this week.
Anything to top that, Stephanie?
I'm proud of my people, too. Scarlett Johansson, ScarJo, our girl, is engaged to...
A piece of white bread.
A piece of white bread, Saturday Night Live writer, Saturday Night Live writer and Weekend Update host, Colin Jost.
The host, Jost?
Jost the host. They're engaged. They've been dating for a while. It's like one of those examples of like a nerdy, like funny guy getting the girl.
Getting the girl.
But I thought if you were like a hot actress or entertainer, you had to marry Pete Davidson.
No, it's very exciting. That's
or
one
a basketball
who is
player.
Not Pete Davidson, has like a celebrity girlfriend who he actually... didn't need to talk about all the time, which was very funny.
Who's Pete Davidson?
Mark.
Who is he?
Stop.
No, really, who is he?
Stop it.
Pete Wentz is a rock star. Who's Pete Davidson?
Pete Wentz is not a rock star.
Isn't he?
When Bush was president.
What
was
he? He's Fallout Boy, but I wouldn't call it. Whatever.
Okay, who's Pete Davidson?
Oh, my God. Wow, Mark. Okay, so Pete Davidson is one of the Saturday Night Live cast members.
Okay.
He dated and became engaged to Ariana Grande over the last summer.
Who's Ariana? No, I know who Ariana Grande is. Because Ellie listens to Ariana Grande.
Everyone write in and make fun of Mark.
All right. We got some live shows to talk about. Hollis Hills, Queens, May 29. Leon Nafach of the podcast Slow Burn and an upcoming podcast called Fiasco will be the Jew of the Week, the Jotwa. And the Gentile of the Week, the Gotwa, will be Claire Malone of the 538 Politics podcast. If you want to come see us in Queens, and why not come see us in Queens? Why not fly into JFK or LaGuardia, hop an Uber, come see us, and then fly home
to
wherever
you...
Yeah, we will pick you
up. The greatest, and I mean that, of New York City's bars.
We will be running a party
flipping
bus...
Flipping Queens, man.
...from the airports to our show. Go to bit.ly/UOLiveQueens. That's bit.ly/UOLiveQueens. Pick up some tickets. Party with us May 29th.
Shavuos and Hollis.
That's right.
As they say.
June 26th, we will be in the Second City, Chi-Town, Chicago. Blair Braverman, the dog-mushing Jewess from the Iditarod Dog Sled Race, will be our Jew of the Week. We'll be in Chicago June 26th. Please come see us. For tickets and information, go to bit.ly/unorthodoxchicago. That's bit.ly/unorthodoxchicago. We want to see you in Chicago on the 26th. May 30th, I will be hosting Hebrew College's Storytelling Gala. Go to hebrewcollege.edu for more information and for tickets. And still time to come learn with me at Thread at Yale. Catherine Burns from The Moth will be there, Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment, James Hamblin from The Atlantic, Sarah Stillman from The New Yorker, Steve Brodner, the caricaturist from The Nation, lots of people, thread.yale.edu. That's June 10th, 11th, and 12th. Hang with me.
Judith Viorst has written many, many books, including a lot of books for children, like Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. Her new poetry collection is Nearing 90 and Other Comedies of Late Life. Welcome, Judith.
Hello.
It's so nice to be chatting with you.
Well, I'm delighted to be with you.
Judith, this is very special for me because I don't know if you remember, but in 2005, you reviewed my book about bar and bat mitzvahs for the Washington Post.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't remember your name, but I certainly remember the book. Yes, indeed.
And it was a lovely review. It was, I was on tenterhooks. Will people like this book? I put a couple years of my life into it. Will it get reviewed anywhere? And then the Washington Post, one of the country's great newspapers, comes out with this review by an author who, of course, practically taught me to read on her children's books, and you called it thoughtful and respectful, and you just had all these things that we could grab off it and put on the back of the paperback copy, which never came because not enough people bought the book. But honestly,
outrageous.
Your review was really one of the highlights. So it's an honor to talk to you today. Thanks for your part in my past.
That's a very sweet coincidence. Thank you.
You're welcome.
So Judith, you've written a book about nearly every decade of your life. There was Forever 50, Suddenly 60. And I'm curious, in Nearing 90, what makes this latest decade different from all other decades?
Well, we're getting close to the end. I mean, when I started out with It's Hard to Be Hip Over 30, life seemed eternal. It doesn't seem quite eternal as I near 90. So there are more... poems about legacies and knee replacements, and though I like to write humorous verse, the laughs are a little bit more of a challenge in the later decades.
Do you want to read any of the poems for us? Do you have a copy of the book handy?
I do. I'd love to read a poem.
I would love that. Would you do that for us?
Sure. In fact, as long as I mentioned Legacy, I think that was the last poem in my book, and that'll cover a lot of territory. Since it's looking as if my legacy isn't shaping up to be peace on earth and universal health care, here's what I'm hoping to be remembered for. Showing up when I say I'm showing up. Sticking with what I've started until it's done. Sending Valentines to all the children in our family until they reach the age of 21 and never, ever leaving the house without eyeliner. Playing a relentless game of Scrabble. Keeping the secrets I promised I would keep. Being able to laugh about the bad things that happened to me, though not before I first whine and weep and rail against my fate and blame my husband. Doing work I'm able to be proud of, making a truly transcendent matzo ball. Coming to terms with mortality, though to be perfectly honest, I'm still not feeling all that thrilled about dying. Coming to terms with not feeling thrilled about dying. Watching over the people that I love, grateful they're watching over me as well. Enjoying whatever there is to enjoy until that final time's up closing bell. And hoping, just a reminder, that I'll be remembered.
I'm so curious because we don't often read about mortality in this open and honest and also very kind of funny way. I mean, was this a difficult book to write?
I think it was a challenging book to write. My publisher, lovely publisher, who is my kid's age, said they wanted me to write a book he'd give to his parents or my age. And he was hoping that, you know, it wasn't going to depress the living hell out of him. He didn't say it that way. But, you know, the concern was, is this all going to be doctor's appointments and moaning and complaining? And I did throw out a lot of poems. I had one about doctors and ailments that went on so long it would have occupied the whole book. So I did some editing, but you know, in order to talk about, I mean, the subtitle of this is Other Comedies of Late Life. My first decade book, which was about being in my 30s, was Tragedies. So I've developed something of a sense of humor over the decades.
I'm 42, and sometimes when I see certain developments, some technological, some cultural, I think to myself, you know, I'm kind of glad it's half over. I really don't want to stick around for that much longer to see how far more we have to go into complete degradation. Do you feel like that sometimes? What are the things that you view about culture right now that make you say to yourself, like, I can't handle this. This is a step too far.
Well, the whole world of technology absolutely overwhelms me. And, you know, when people say, I'll come over and I'll teach you something, I say, I would rather use my brain to memorize poetry. That's what I'm doing in my old age. I've memorized parts or wholes of 55 poems, and it makes me much happier than knowing how to do something with an attachment that probably shouldn't
incredible.
Even be done.
So I went through a period where I was memorizing a lot of poems. It was about 10 or 12 years ago before I had kids. I've forgotten them all. What are some of the poems? I'm curious, what are you memorizing? What are some of the poems that you're so happy to have in your brain?
Oh, everything. I mean, old and new. I memorized Yeats and I memorized Eliot and Gerard Manley Hopkins and Billy Collins and E.E. Cummings, some Shakespeare. And the way you don't forget them, I'll give you a little advice, is you have to drill. You memorize them and you own them, but only for a little while. And you just have to drill. And at regular intervals, maybe once a month, you go through all of your poetry and you recite it to yourself. The important thing is, and if you want to keep your relationships with your friends, is don't impose your memorized poetry on them. They will not love you for it.
So, Judith, you write a lot in here about your husband, Milton. And it's a lot of it is very sweet, but it's also like honest and open about the sort of challenges of being married. You guys got married in, I believe, 1960.
Right. And almost 60 years.
And there's one great, great poem. It's called A Warning or Maybe a Love Song for My Husband. And a line that gets repeated is, "Don't you dare die before me."
Right. I feel very strongly about that. I'm not even kidding.
And I'm so curious how your writing about him has changed over the years, because I know you've sort of always been open about what it's like to be in a very long marriage.
Well, I have always been very clear that being married is this combination of dumb luck and hard work. I mean, you have no idea when you get married that this is the person you're going to still like 5, 10, 50 years from now, or that you're not going to change in ways that are irreconcilable. And, you know, and if you aren't a perfect match to begin with, then you have to put in a lot of hard work if you want to preserve a marriage. And we're two very, very bossy people with opinions on everything. I practically had a heart attack when I got married and discovered he even had an opinion on what color the refrigerator should be. That was my department. What was he doing having an opinion about the refrigerator? But I think the main quality that has not changed in my writing about marriage is, and about my family too, and the reason I get away with a lot is, the person I make the most fun of in my poetry is me. I'm not sitting in some superior place looking down at these foolish mortals with all their failures and flaws while perfect me is just carrying on magnificently. You know, if I say my husband's a pain in the ass, I'm a pain in the ass too, and that's very clear.
Judith Forrest, thank you so much for being on our show. We love the book. It's called Nearing 90 and Other Comedies of Late Life.
And listen, we really need I don't know what the alliteration is, but 100 book would be nice.
Pushing 100.
Yeah.
That's right. Pushing 100, not up daisies.
I like that.
If we're still podcasting in 10 years, we insist that you have a book for us, okay?
Okay, we have a date.
All right, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Mailbox. First of all, we got a nice note from Mimi Eisenberger, our listener in Vienna, who said, "You may be pleased to know that the unorthodox..."
Mimi Eisenhower? That would be great. I love your show.
I'm still alive, living in Vienna.
I'm listening to Unorthodox from the great beyond. Ike loves it too. Truman is not a fan.
Mimi Eisenhower in Vienna.
That was the first Mimi Eisenhower joke made on an American podcast ever.
Ever. 71 said who Mimi Eisenhower is, right?
She was in Saturday Night Live.
I'm going to tell you what Mimi Eisenberger says. "You may be pleased to know that the Unorthodox podcast was recommended in the April edition of the magazine of the Austrian Jewish community, WINA, alongside Two Nice Jewish Boys and other mostly German Jewish-themed podcasts."
All right.
All the best from Vienna, Mimi Eisenberger.
I don't know how the phrase mostly German Jewish-themed podcast. Yeah.
Hi, J. Crew. My name is Grace, and I have a scenario sort. I go to a local community college, and I met a person, a really nice guy, who goes to the local kabod, and he wanted to know my Jewish name, so I told him, and ever since then, he's been calling me by it, and I don't know whether to be flattered or to be creeped out or... I don't know. Yeah, that's it. Thank you.
Okay, so here's the thing.
Can I say this may be the favorite note that we ever got.
So the Chabad, local Chabad guy said, "What's your Jewish name?" She said, it's Devorah or Esti or whatever." And now when he sees her, instead of calling
on
her
on campus, yeah,
he calls her by her Hebrew name.
That's his little erotic.
Yeah,
treat.
I mean, this to me seems like he's hitting on her. Like he's trying to sort of flirt a little bit and have established a connection with you.
It's like, hey, Chava,
yeah.
Why don't you go back to my shtiebel and drink a little
bit? It's actually Chava Rachel is my name. You gotta go back.
Hey, Chava Rachel.
But like, I think he's trying to sort of be a little cute and have this connection with you. I think you can say just like, please don't call. I mean, if it makes you uncomfortable, you can say stop. I think you could also recognize it as like he's trying to sort of probably be sweet and flirt with you. And like, it's clearly not working.
Okay, so I disagree.
What?
I have had the experience of Lubavitcher specifically saying, "What's your Hebrew name?" I wasn't given one, but when I need one, I go with my grandfather's, which was Chaim, just because, sort of in honor of
my
grandfather Walter.
I support that.
And I've had the experience of Lubavitcher's thereafter being like, "Chaim, what's up?" And I don't think they're flirting with me. I think it's a way
they might be.
Mark, come on.
They may be.
With that hair?
But I think it's something that they do to say, like, you know, we deal on Yiddish time here, like we or Jewish time, like we deal. I think it's a Kiruv thing, an outreach thing that they do. And I think that I bet our listeners will concur that it happens in non-sexual ways all the time and that we should presume it's not. I mean, the bottom line is if she doesn't like it, she should say, don't call me that.
Yeah,
but
she
began by saying, should I be flattered or creeped out? The easier answer is closer to flattered than creeped out, but you're still allowed to opt out.
Here's correct. The thing. I actually don't like that. I have an English name. This is like I think there's a presumption there that actually my Hebrew name is better. Like
what is your Hebrew name?
Chava Rachel.
Chava Rachel.
Or as I was in my Yiddish class, Chava Fir, because there were four. I was the fourth Chava in the class. But you know, it's funny. There's the diamond guy that Ben got my engagement ring from, who Cliff, my brother-in-law, had used, and Cliff was like, by the way, you have to use your Hebrew name with him. So Cliff, he's like, oh, you know Chaim, because Cliff is Chaim. And so Ben had to be like, I'm Ben Zion. I know Chaim. And I'm like, what the hell is going on here? That you have to like.
I love it.
Wait, but let's go a little deeper here.
It's like a skull and bones.
That's the thing.
Oh, hey, Chaim.
And so I think if someone was just to call me Chava, I'd be like, okay, I have, that's like a realm in which I don't really identify with because I'm Stephanie. But Stefani, if you want to, you know.
First of all, this is one of the best. This is one of the best voicemails
yes,
we've ever gotten.
Absolutely.
Absolutely great question. Just I'll speak personally here, right? Like, sure, I'm Mark. There's no part of me that I'm like, if someone yells Chaim on the street,
I'm not turning around.
What?
Well, you assume like, they're talking to Cliff.
I'm Mark. Right. I, you know, to friends from high school, I'm Oppie. You know, there's a few things that I to my kids, I'm Dad. to Sid, I'm Mio, which my initials, M-E-O. Like, there's things I answer to.
Wow,
there
that
is
was
no,
very intimate. I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
I start emails to M-E-O, so now I know that.
Yeah, and there's no part of me that answers to a Hebrew name. That said, like, it's so obviously meant, whether it's affection or like, hey, this is my outreach shtick, which I think is fun. Like, there's no part of me that's bothered by people giving me non-offensive nicknames or like personal name. Like, why would I be bothered? It's just one of those things in life where like it can only be a nice and affectionate thing. And to be bothered by it, it speaks to some, I will say it. I think it's like the part of you that doesn't want a mezuzah on your door.
No.
It's like, don't Jew me in public.
No. It's the part of me that was more uncomfortable during the Chabad episode than you guys were. Like we talked all about that. Like this idea that like you are asserting something about me. You're calling me by this name.
Call me by Chaim's name.
But let me try this on for a second.
My discomfort about being Jewish. It's just like I am reading into it a kind of like, this is who we want you to be.
What they're asserting is, I think you're right, but I think what they're asserting is nothing more or less than you are a Jew. And in our interactions with you, we will remind, like, it will always be foregrounded that we are two Jews talking. And
yeah,
I think
that's fine.
But and as you are.
Yeah, but I think if I
got. As you're frequently uncomfortable with.
No. Guys, I have a mezuzah on my door. It was there when I got there. It's really ugly, and I have all these other mezuzahs that people have sent me, and I don't know what to do because I need someone to take the mezuzah down because I don't know how to, like, really.
I mean, you're so uncomfortable that you chose to work for a Jewish publication.
I know, yeah. So deeply disappointed.
What do you think?
No, I'm with you. I find it really charming.
But
I have
a Hebrew name, so it's hard for
you. That's right.
To...
My name is Leah Leibowitz.
It's barely even a Hebrew name. It's like a cobbled together sci-fi fantasy name.
It's a Kabbalah fantasy, right?
It's Jor-El. It's a Superman name.
I agree with you. If she's uncomfortable, that you should just be like, hey, dude, listen, you know, it's best Bethany.
But it's like, but to me, this is like a guy. Charming called, and like, awesome. I'm seeing in this like, oh, a guy is like, women operate in the world on so, with so many things being put on them. And now there's like a guy calling her by a name that's not how, like, it's just a lot of, it's a lot. And
on.
You guys maybe don't understand all like what I'm reading into it, the subtext of these interactions.
I could definitely see that also, that like male to female, it's a little bit like, hey, babe, I'm giving you like, hey, Schnooky.
Yeah.
Hey, Shwee Shwee.
Yeah. Hey, hun.
Shwee Shwee is her Hebrew name.
Shwee Shwee is her name.
Our Gentile of the Week is Edward Lee. He's the chef owner of several restaurants in Louisville, Kentucky, and just won the James Beard Award for his book, Buttermilk Graffiti, a memoir of his culinary journey across the United States. Hi, Edward.
Hi, all. How are you?
We are good. We are very happy to have
great.
You here.
I will say your book is one of those very, very, very rare books that I finished and saying, you know, fuck, I wish I could be friends with that guy. It's amazing.
That's awesome.
Man.
Thank you.
So you basically drop into a bunch of different communities, a lot of them immigrant communities throughout the United States. And I'd love for you to just start off by explaining what happened to you when you went to Dearborn.
Yeah. So, you know, the idea was to go into these, you know, food communities, you know, most of them ethnic, to sort of do a deeper dive into just how they live, how the food and the culture and the way of life there is all sort of intertwined. And one of the stops was in Dearborn, Michigan, which is home to the largest Muslim population in the country. And I hadn't fully done my research, and I realized that when I went to Dearborn, it was during Ramadan. So everyone was fasting, which is not exactly the perfect week to do a food story. And obviously, you know, it's a holy week. People were not really, they were preoccupied. They weren't really, you know, looking to talk to someone about food. And something happens, and you can read it in the book, and I have this sort of epiphany, I guess, where I decide that I'm going to participate in the fast. And mind you, I've never fasted before in my entire life, and I'm a chef. So needless to say, it was a tough experience. But in that experience, something happened where I was able to connect with the locals. And I go to this restaurant, I order food, and I didn't eat it, and I just took pictures of it. And the lady asked me why I wasn't eating the food, and I said, "Well, I'm observing Ramadan." And she said, "Well, you're not Muslim, though." I said, "No, I'm not Muslim, but I'm here to write about the food, and I figured the only way to really understand the food is to respect the culture." And in that moment, everything changed, and her demeanor was more friendly. She all of a sudden introduced me to her husband, who knew a lot, you know. And then I got introduced to a mosque, then I got introduced to other people, and I realized that there is a way that and what I do is not food journalism, but I think there's a way that we talk about other people's cultures, and a lot of it starts with just respecting the culture and respecting their rules, their religions, and then we can talk about the food.
And that's so amazing, because usually if you're like, befriend a chef, they'll like bring you out a free dessert or something. In this case, it's like, I will honor you by not bringing you a dessert.
Yes, exactly, exactly.
So you are the child of Korean immigrants who grew up in Brooklyn, and you end up in Louisville, Kentucky. Can you explain how you got there?
Yeah, I mean, it's a long, long story, but I basically spent my whole life in New York, never really left, and then opened up a restaurant when I was 25 in downtown, and 9/11 happened. And when 9/11 happened, it kind of, I lost my business, and I lost a friend who was in the towers. You know, a lot of things got shaken up, and I just decided that I had to leave New York for a while, and I took some road trips around the country, and just by chance ended up in Louisville, Kentucky during the Derby. And if for any of your listeners who has not been to the Kentucky Derby, it's a lot of bourbon, a lot of food, a lot of, you know, pretty ladies in pretty dresses. So three things that I really enjoy. And it just kind of, I don't know, there was something about it that really just moved me. And I thought, oh, this is the kind of place I could stay. And then the gentleman that I worked for at the time was retiring, and he asked me to take over his restaurant. So I thought, well, I have nothing else going on right now. Why not? I'll do it. And if I don't like it, I can always go back to New York. So I signed a 6-month contract, and that was now 17 years ago, and I'm still there.
Now, Edward Lee, author of Buttermilk Graffiti, you write something in this book that's quite disturbing to us.
Shocking, even.
Yes.
Could get you banned from many Jewish media platforms. Yes. You write that the best kosher deli in the country is to be found in, I don't even know how to pronounce it. Leah, what's it called again?
It's Indianapolis, I believe.
Indiana?
This very foreign city called Indianapolis.
What is this restaurant, and why is it in Indiana, and how can we explain the world?
It's an incredible Jewish deli called Shapiro's. It's been there for over 100 years. It's got an incredible history. The food is outstanding. But there's something different about it, you know, versus the LA and the New York delis, which, even though they exist in their realm, they've been touched by modernism. They've been influenced by their, you know, gentrification, by you know, both cities are very global and international and very contemporary. And when you go to a place like Shapiro's, the history is still there. And it's almost as if they've lived in a bubble for the last 80 to 100 years. And there's still something really palpable about it. It's not just a set of vintage pictures on the wall. I mean, there are people who dine there, whose parents have dined there, whose grandparents have dined there, who have stories about having their you know, wedding party there. There are sometimes places where culture survives because there's a necessity to it. And there's a lot of people in that community who rely on Shapiro's to be there because of its historical importance. And you can say that about the other delis and everywhere in New York and LA, but you know, there's something about New York where you know, even Katz's and Russ and Daughters, they get kind of lost, or they get caught up in sort of the modernization of the neighborhood that they're around. And Shapiro's is in a terrible neighborhood. I mean, there's nothing there.
Now, the question of what is, you know, the best kind of deli also gets very political with us. And this one, Shapiro's, for example, I have read is kosher style, but not actually kosher. Mm-hmm. And this goes to your question for us, because every Gentile of the Week has the opportunity to ask us a question about kashrut or kosher law.
Yes.
So what was the question that you wanted to bring to us?
So the question I had was, and you know, I get different versions of answers depending on who I ask, you know, why pork is forbidden. And a lot of times the answers I get is that, well, it's you know, uncleanly. And my question was, you know, with modern advances in modern agriculture and farming and the whole organic movement, would there ever be a revisiting of that rule to look at some of it and to say that, oh, you know, we can now incorporate pork into the diet?
So essentially, kosher law isn't about animals not being unclean. It's about the fact that pork and shellfish are not permitted items, right? Like, so for animals to be kosher, they need to have split hooves, this is according to the Bible, and to chew its cud. And so pork fundamentally, you know, and for fish, there has to be fins and scales. So it's actually less about how the animal is prepared or all this, all, you know, something that all these modern advancements could change. It's like about the animal its essence, basically, being impure.
And the rabbis in their wisdom knew that pork was also just too delicious, and we can't really handle the deliciousness. But if we were permitted this,
we don't deserve things that
you would just go crazy.
Yeah, as I did before I went kosher, we would eat this 6 times a day, which is really not good for you.
I'll tell you a funny story. In the American South, which is where I live and I do a lot of my traveling, it's the only place in the world that I have come across many, many Jews who say, listen, I'm kosher, I don't eat pork. except for bacon. I just make one excuse for bacon.
And I've heard this many times. Except for bacon, ribs, ham, Canadian bacon,
pork chops,
and anything that's in Chinese food where I can't tell that it's pork because it's smothered in a sauce. I mean, look, you very profoundly get right to the heart of a big question within Judaism, because the Reform movement, one of their signature innovations, if you will, is that they said these laws don't make sense in contemporary society, and we're going to eat treif. We're going to eat non-kosher food. So, you know, there's long, for hundreds of years, there's been a recognition that there's no actual scientific basis. I mean, yes, once upon a time, 500 or 1,000 years ago, you might have thought, well, you know, the pigs play in the dirt, therefore they're unclean. And that could have been part of what was going on when the Torah was written. Mm-hmm. But for people who still keep those laws, it's not because they're under any illusion that it's a cleanliness matter. It's because that's what the book says. Yeah. And so they're keeping to, you know, as Stephanie says, like, the rules are not actually about cleanliness. They're about a particular kinds of animals, and those aren't negotiable.
Interesting.
But Shapiro's is kosher style, which basically means that it probably means the meat they serve is kosher, but they're also serving dairy products in the building.
Yeah,
so
they do. Open on Saturdays, probably.
Yeah. So no actual Orthodox Jew or Jew who keeps kosher would eat there, but it has the feel of kashrut for people who want the old timey religion.
Right, gotcha. But the chopped liver,
I'm sure there's stuff that's like Korean style, right?
It's pretty damn good.
And you would know because you wrote the chopped liver entry for our 100 most Jewish foods book. Which is great. Edward Lee, thank you so much. Buttermilk Graffiti, A Chef's Journey to Discover America's New Melting Pot Cuisine, is newly a James Beard Award winning book. And we're so excited to chat with you.
Thank you. Thank you for having
me. Thank you.
Mazel tovs.
And Siman tovs.
I want to start with a mazel tov for Dr. Rachel Rosenthal, PhD. She's going to get the before and after the name. Dr. Rachel Rosenthal, PhD. Sometimes known as Mrs. Yair Rosenberg of Tablet Magazine.
Actually, I think Yair is known as Mr. Dr.
Rachel Rosenthal. She is receiving her PhD in Talmud from the Jewish Theological Seminary today, Thursday, the day this is airing. We are here on Tuesday. But as you hear this, she's about to walk, and she will be addressing all the graduates at that ceremony. So Dr. Rachel Rosenthal, PhD, mazel tov to you.
And because it's a PhD in Talmud, as soon as she delivers her speech, someone else is going to come on and say why she was wrong.
That's right. Make a commentary. That's right. Stephanie.
I have a mazel tov to Shira Borzak and Alex Eidman on their upcoming wedding this weekend. And also a shout out to their matchmaker, Jordana Bernstein, who set up her best friend from high school with her husband's best friend from high school.
Oh, that's interesting. If I set up my best friend from high school with Sid's best friend from high school.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's basically it's kind of how like your porn star name is like the street you grew up.
Yeah. That would be like John Heffernan, who went on to write Snakes on a Plane, I'll just pick him among my close. I didn't really have a best friend from high school. With Sid's best friend from high school, Casey Jarin. Yeah, I think they're both single. We should do that.
Oh, my God.
I think we should do that.
I see you have him on the
show. This involves everyone calling their best friend from high school and being like, hey.
Totally.
So it's been a while, but.
Yeah, but I'm married now, and my spouse has a best friend from high school. Leah, what you got?
I have two mazel tovs to two great heroes of the Jewish people. The first is my hero, Howard Stern, who has an amazing, amazing new book this week out, Howard Stern Comes Again. A very candid and touching and glorious book of interviews with famous people who do not come off as jerks. But my second mazel tov is to someone who is so young and so impressive. I want to give a very, very special mazel tov to the incredible 11-year-old girl in Tennessee who last week did a very brave thing. She stood up to kids and the administration in her school when a teacher assigned a project that involved, for some reason, giving a Nazi salute. After the project ended, the salutes continued, and this incredible,
brave, kick-ass young girl who is not Jewish was having none of it. She stood up to both her fellow students and to the teachers and administrators of her stupid school. So kudos to you. We also heard you're a Harry Potter fan. So sent you a little care package, a couple of books, the Harry Potter Haggadah and Harry Potter Book of Esther. And we want to really thank you for sticking up for what's right. Rock on. As they say in Hebrew, Yishar Koach.
Unorthodox brought to you by Tablet Magazine, on the web at tabletmag.com. Send thoughts to unorthodox at tabletmag.com. Get our newsletter at bit.ly/unorthodoxpodcast. Leave us voicemails at 914-570-4869. I repeat, 914-570-4869. Put it on speed dial. We often come to you live to book us or advertise with us. Email producer Josh Cross at jcross, that's with a K, at tabletmag.com. Follow us on Instagram at unorthodoxpodcast, on Twitter at unorthodox_pod. Join our Facebook group along with thousands of other enlightened and stimulated Facebook groupies. Our show is produced by Josh Cross. Our associate producers are Sarah Fredman-Ader and Noah Levinson. Our artwork is by Esther Werdiger. Our social media meshkiach is Elazar A. Abrams. Our theme music is by Golem, online at golemrocks.com. Our mailbox theme is by Steve Barton. Rabbinic supervision by Haniel Levinson, who officiated at the wedding of Sarah Cohen and David Silver. And we come to you from Argo Studios, which is so bitter that Sarah Cohen and David Silver are off the market now. Shalom, friends.